Coming up on Harvard Chan this week in health, harnessing data to improve our lives.
Having access to the right data can make the problem you're trying to solve just look completely different.
We now have access to more data than ever before. And in this week's episode, we're speaking with two scientists who are at the forefront of the field of data science, using vast amounts of information to address everything from health challenges, such as pollution or drug efficacy, to policy and decision making. Hello and welcome to Harvard Chan This Week in Health. It's Thursday, April 20th, 2017. I'm Noah Levitt.
And I'm Amy Montemiro.
In this week's episode, we're talking all about data. What it is, where we find it, how we can use it to address a range of challenges.
And whether or not it's plural or singular. Okay, we won't be delving into that issue, but we will be talking with Francesca Domenici and David Parks, who are co-directors of a new data science initiative at Harvard.
Domenici is professor of biostatistics here at the Harvard Chan School, and Parks is George F. Colony professor and area dean for computer science at the Harvard John A. Paulson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. They'll be working together to organize data science efforts across the university while mentoring young researchers and students.
It's an ambitious initiative, and the potential impact is broad. The applications of data science span healthcare, the environment, commerce, urban planning, finance, and more. And a key goal for Domenici and Parks is taking lessons, methodology, and tools from one area and translating it to another.
We brought Domenici and Parks into our studio for an in-depth conversation about data science, how the field has grown, where it's going, and how it will affect our lives in vast ways over the coming years. Take a listen. For people who don't know, but maybe they hear this term a lot, what is data science?
I was going to first of all start with what is data? You know, because I think when you say data, people often think numbers. And I wanted to make the point that data is a lot more than numbers. So data might be text, it might be images, it might be decisions. It's not just quantitative. It could be more qualitative of that form. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to start there, and then we need to then begin to unpack what we have in mind when we say data science. And we emphasize that it's three things coming together. It's the methodology, it's the application, and it's the contextualization. And we think that Harvard's very well placed to be able to move the field forward, given that we have those strengths.
I think that, you know, what is very exciting right now is that across, say, most of the school at Harvard, all our faculty and scientists are doing their, you know, they're basically increasingly relying on this complex data and whatever is their form to advance their science. And I think that what we hope to achieve and what we do mean by data science is by taking both the methodological rigor and the enormous amount of advances in computation and in data visualization, and then bring it to bear with the top scientific questions so that we can really impact the way as we live and impact in terms of in the social sciences and the biomedical sciences and even in the humanities, because we can use these massive amount of data and extract new knowledge.
And you kind of just touched on it there, that these massive amounts of data, I mean, it seems like, from my perspective, this is kind of like, if you're working with data, it's kind of a golden era. There's data and there's information everywhere. So what kinds of information do you as scientists now have access to that maybe you didn't have access to a few years ago?
I think that in the general area of, we can even just say public health and in the general area of environmental sciences and, you know, and climate change that everybody's now very interested and you know, kind of worried about it, is that, for example, we now can rely on data from satellite, from NASA, to measure the levels of pollution, how contaminated the air is, not all in the United States, but also around the world. Even in our, you know, cohort studies, and I know that here there is the Nurses' Health study. Now with the Nurses' Health study, they are measuring genetic and genomic information that they we didn't have access before. And more generally, in the context of medicine and biomedical sciences, in addition to the explosion of additional information on the genome, we also have access to electronic medical record and claims data. These are all new sorts of information that we didn't have before and we have now, and I think open, you know, a lot of new opportunities.
There are lots of examples of why data is important. One story I like to recall is that for years, Microsoft was trying to understand how to build technology to understand gestures. They want these gesture-based interfaces into Xbox, and seemed like a very, very challenging problem. The way they solved the problem was to pay actors to form particular gestures and collect a data set that nobody had ever collected before. So that's an example of how data can, having access to the right data can make the problem you're trying to solve just look completely different. And to go back to satellites, so people are using satellites and are using street view type views from Google to understand cities in ways that haven't been understood before as well.
What are kind of some of the way that scientists, I mean, either of you personally in your work or just kind of your colleagues who you're working with here, what are some of the ways that scientists are kind of taking this data and then applying it to real world problems?
I can talk about a very interesting piece of research that I heard about yesterday, which was using data from how senators vote to try to back out kind of log rolling behavior in Congress. So log rolling is something that sounds bad, but I think most political scientists would actually argue is a good thing. It's where you do these trades over time with other politicians. Mm-hmm. So you would intrinsically vote one way, but you're going to vote another way because you'll reach another compromise in the future. Mm-hmm. There's also often thought about as vote trading. So the question is, from just the log roll data of how people are voting, whether you can back out this latent structure, this missing structure that's not in the data, to understand what deals were being struck behind the scenes. I think that's probably not a particularly new data set, but it's a data set where we're bringing new methodologies to bear on it to, this is not my research, but to understand what's going on in that space. And I'll talk to another example. There are chemists in the FAS who are using methods from machine learning to try to find molecules with good chemical properties. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you the space of molecules is uncountably infinite. If you actually want to think about how big that space is, you put together all different strings, and different strings will express different properties. And suppose you're trying to find a molecule that will emit, say, a blue light. I can't just test all of the molecules in the world. What I can try to do is I can try to build a model to predict which molecules will have the properties I care about. And then the ones that seem particularly promising, I can go ahead and I can only incur the cost and I can only test those molecules. So it's using data science, is using in this case, again, probabilistic modeling and prediction to try to accelerate the pace with which we do scientific discovery of new molecules.
So could you tell us a little bit, we've heard some of the applications that can be used, but one of the terms I hear getting thrown around is research platform. So would you mind talking to us a little bit about how data science, you know, how figuring out the best ways to use information can then be used to inform, you know, just about any topic in the world? So research platform.
So if you're thinking about the general goal now of precision medicine, which there are so many people working on it, and it's so critically important, is the fact that different people benefit or not benefit of a particular treatment depending on their genetic background, but not only about their gene, but also about their life experience, what they eat and what they breed. I mean, you know, this makes so much sense, right? How you respond to a particular treatment or how likely is that you have a certain disease is a combination of your genetic background and, you know, the environment your disease in, right? Mm-hmm. And let's say now you're drilling into a specific question. You want to know whether drug A is better than drug B for treating cancer. Well, you now start to having, you have to collect all of the genetic information about the people. You have to collect about everything about where they've been exposed, where they live, everything about. So there's going to be different sources of data, you know. So when we're talking about the genome, there is a source of data, and they have all of their own challenges and complications that you need to understand. They have to be clean. They have to be understood. They have to be analyzed. Linked to all of the data about where they live, what they eat, what they're exposed, linked to all of their, what we call the phenotype information, mm-hmm. you know, biomarker, blood pressure, right? And this is takes, it's enormous amount of work. It's taking all of this data, understanding it, documenting it, link it in a way that is highly sophisticated and validated. So then you could have student, postdoctoral fellow, faculty, hundreds of people relying on the same, you know, research platform that is bulletproof. When you're dealing in the context of data science, and because going back to what David was saying, that this type of data are so complex, building research platform is basically collecting and analyze and collecting and linking and documenting and maybe pre-filtering. There is an entire field of statistical methodology about denoising data in the same way that you are denoising musical signal. You have to denoise genetic information. You have to denoise imaging data. So the research platform is going from a lot of, you know, crazy messy to something together that then you can start to learn from it.
In addition to all the work that has to be done to bring the data together, then there's the algorithmic piece that happens after you have the data. So research platform is also about tools as well. And for example, Google has been doing a fantastic job in releasing tools that are really accelerating the pace with which people are able to do very sophisticated things with data. So they have a whole system called TensorFlow where you can describe these kind of high-dimensional, what are called neural network-based models. And then once you've described your model in a language, the tool chain will take care of the rest. It will take the derivatives automatically for you. So you don't need to remember your calculus if you're not a mathematical expert. Okay? So the derivatives are done. And then it will distribute the calculations of the derivatives over lots of computational cores. And so this is also part of a platform. And universities need to make sure that we're keeping current with the right tools to enable the right data science. Because what we have that's very special in a university is we have these very compelling grand challenge problems that generally companies in Silicon Valley have less of, although say I have great respect for what's happening in Silicon Valley, but universities do have these very societally impactful grand challenge problems, and we need to find the right way to bring the best people to Harvard and other universities by connecting them and motivating them through solving these challenge problems, and having the right tools, the right platforms available is really crucial.
So one of the interesting things you've talked about, Francesca, is how data can be used to inform policy.
Yeah.
So what does this look like in practice?
Yeah.
And especially thinking about how it's related to environmental issues.
Yeah. Policy and important changing in policy should be informed by science. I think in the context of both in the environment, in the context of medicine, and I think what really doesn't mean is in the context of environmental sciences and what, you know, the EPA, which we hope that, you know, will continue to be that way, is that, you know, the EPA has been setting what we call this National Ambient Air Quality Standard. These are safety standard for all the United States, where the minimum level of air pollution that are, you know, they're supposed to protect our health. And through data science and through the work is we have been providing now consistent evidence that ambient level of pollution below the current and standard are still harmful to human health. And so I think when we talk about how science informs policy, I do think that it's so important to keep have the bar really high in using the best possible data in this context, was it for the environment, but also in the context of medicine or in the context of economic behavior. There is an enormous amount of exciting work in the context of healthcare policy, where we take the most reliable source of data, and from what the data said, that should inform policy making.
And from your perspective, David, how can we harness data to improve decision making?
Yeah, when I think about decision making, I think about the need for causal modeling, which is something Francesca already mentioned, and is not only very important, but an area where Harvard has always had a very strong research effort and has had world-leading contributions. For example, one of the decisions that e-commerce firms need to make is how to set the price for goods that they're selling. And imagine needing to do that for hundreds of millions of goods if you want to be the store for everything. So it's a very challenging problem. Now, if you are naive about this, you will see that in the holiday season, when there's very high demand, you may also have high prices. You know, you have high prices because there is very high demand. Mm-hmm. And so if you're naive about this, it might look as though a higher price, somehow higher demand. That looks great. So if I'm going to use that data to set my price, I've got my demand curve going in completely the wrong direction. Of course, there was something else that changed there, which was that all of a sudden you had all this new demand in the system. Or if you are a doctor and you're trying to understand what treatment is the right treatment to give your patient, if you use data in the wrong way, there can be all these confounds that can lead you to come to the wrong conclusion because there are things you haven't seen that were going on that explained why a particular treatment had been given. So I'm very firm of the belief that we're actually only at the start of developing these techniques for building models that are causal. In particular, when I think about it from a artificial intelligence perspective, we're very close now to seeing in lots of settings AI making decisions automatically. And if that AI has been trained not understanding the difference between a causally predictive model and a predictive model, the AI is going to make the wrong decisions.
So I have to ask, because we've been talking about causal inference, is this had anything to do with correlation and causation? Is that where we get that phrase?
Yes.
Great.
Well, so and I kind of wanted to ask, like, is that because I'd wanted to like kind of largely ask about some of the risks of big data and data in general. Is that kind of the flip side and the risk that we have all this data and that we might be too eager to say we need to find a way to use this? So I guess what are some of the things that you need to be mindful of as scientists as you're working through this data and trying to learn from it and interpret it?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, sometimes what I like to say is that the fact that you have a lot of data, without some rigorous statistical thinking, you could get a lot of confusion. So a lot of data, maybe with a lot of rigor, will give you a lot of good information. But and I think the difference between causation and correlation, it's a classical example where people have a massive amount of data and they look for pattern and they say, oh, well, you know, there is this particular element, you know, this particular feature is having, you know, changing over time is increasing, and these other things is increasing as well. So one caused the other one. Well, no. It's not that simple. And so I think that's where what we hope is to really, not only internally at Harvard, but most importantly to impact the science, you know, in general, by be able to add the necessary rigor. So then data means new knowledge and information and not confusion.
I read, I think it was in The Atlantic, it was about this growing field of apps in the legal field that are kind of able to use like previous, you know, information about cases to make like a legal recommendation. Okay. So from a consumer perspective, in 5 or 10 years, are we going to have much more data decision making like available to us? Like, are we getting to that point where we'll increasingly be kind of like farming out decisions in our everyday life to artificial intelligence?
And there's already more of this happening than you probably realize. So we're already at a point where judges are using decision support tools to try to predict whether or not an individual will recommit a crime if they're let out on bail. And we're at a point where there are policing departments around the country using predictive technology to try to predict where they'll see crimes. And if you think about it, the concern is clear. The concern is that you are using existing data sets to make predictions to then make decisions from, and that if the existing data sets reflect biases in our current society, then you're not getting to better decisions. You're predicting what you would have decided in the past. And if you had biases around race or gender as to who you thought would recommit a crime or not, and therefore who would who could go out on bail or not, that can lead to censoring in your data. It can lead to missing observations. If your police force had never tried to enforce, minor crime to do with drugs in white neighborhoods, then your predictive model is going to say, don't bother looking. There are no crimes like that there. And so there are many things that, that people worry about in the context of decision-making from data. And Harvard's a wonderful place, we believe, to help to address these questions in regard to fairness. What does fairness mean? How can you define that? In regard to privacy, what does privacy mean? How can you define that? In regard to reliability and safety, what do they mean? How can you define them? Once you've defined them, how can you build systems that respect those definitions? So there's a whole lot of really important things to work on here.
So it's a matter of, if I'm hearing you correctly, so are we talking about making sure that omitted variable bias does not then create confirmation bias?
That's right. Okay. Very, very good.
Thanks.
Very impressed.
On the flip side, I guess, we kind of talked about kind of some of the concerns, but I kind of want to try to finish on a positive note. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think you've both kind of touched on like all of this, like this wide, incredible array of possibilities. But I guess personally, what are some of the big questions that you kind of hope data will allow you to answer in the years ahead? Like things that you're either personally passionate about or just important issues that you kind of hope data will give you new insight into?
I do think that all of these area of precision medicine, even though we have made tremendous amount of advance, I do think that we still have been looking in a very myopic way of one drug at a time and one problem at a time, where both in terms of what type of medicine we take or how we behave, it's never one at a time. And so going back to the rigor, it's kind of, if you think about, it's a kind of silly of studying the effect of one drug versus another, keeping, you know, everything else constant, which we all know it's not constant. So in terms of precision, and I think I'm using these two buzzwords, which is precision public health and precision medicine. And precision public health is really who are the people that will be mostly beneficial of responding to any type of public health intervention, and precision medicine, who are the people, and by who I mean based on their genetic background and based on their behavior, that could benefit more of something else. And this is so important, is because we are now in an area where everything becomes so personalized, and there are so many other new drugs or new interventions that are out, and I think that we really have to be cautious about, you know, what will be really helpful and for whom.
One of the things that I'm interested in at the moment, which I think society would benefit greatly from, is better understanding how information flows around social networks, mm-hmm. how we form our beliefs about things, how we make decisions, how our opinions are influenced. So these are things that we don't understand and clearly have a large impact on our society. Mm-hmm. More broadly than that, I tend to gravitate myself towards thinking about things that our society facing are things of like, what are the right policy instruments to make our cities function in a better way? We don't understand the way our macroeconomic systems work. Mm-hmm. The feds use pretty complicated equilibrium-based models, but they're very, very simplistic in the sense that they don't get to modeling the decision-making at the household level. They kind of model everybody in a block making one type of decision, and they're not at a level of detail that I think is needed. They fail to predict the financial crisis because they fail to predict the contagion effects that would happen over a network when things fail. So I guess I tend to think about trying to understand these pretty complicated socioeconomic with technology systems. And I think if we can, and lots of our world looks like that these days, and if we can find a way to better understand that, then maybe we can improve decision making both at the individual level and at the level of cities and also governments. And for me, that would be, it's very challenging, but it would be great to be able to get towards that.
That was our conversation with Francesca Domenici and David Parks on Harvard's new data science initiative.
And one thing Domenici and Parks are especially excited about is the opportunity to work with students from their respective schools and across the university. For them, one of the key goals of the data science initiative is mentoring the next generation of data scientists, a group that will likely have access to even more information in the years ahead.
If you want to learn more about the Data Science Initiative, you can visit our website, hsph.me/thisweekinhealth.
And coming up in next week's episode, a disturbing epidemic in Greece's refugee camps. We'll speak with the authors of a new report highlighting rampant sexual exploitation and abuse of migrant children.
Until next week, you can listen to this podcast anytime at soundcloud.com/harvardpublichealth or subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher.